Today is Tuesday, September the 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. The 76th session of the UN General Assembly kicks off its high-level week. The gathering will debate expanding access to COVID-19 vaccines and confronting the rising dangers of climate change. But after a year of an all-virtual General Assembly, is New York City ready for gridlock or diplomatic action?
I think there's actually excitement about having a big gathering again after so many months of COVID restrictions, COVID lockdowns. And for the city, it's really an economic boost to have leaders in town.
And Philippines boxing legend Manny Pacquiao announces that he will run for president of the Philippines in the next year's elections. But how would his policies differ from those of his former ally and incumbent president Rodrigo Duterte?
Your old lawmaker also emphasized that the Filipinos need a decent government to serve the people with integrity, compassion, and transparency.
And the Ronan Court has sentenced Poru Sesabagina, a one-time hotel manager, portrayed as a hero in a Hollywood film about the 1994 Tutsi genocide, to 25 years in prison on terror charges. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, more than 100 world leaders are expected in New York City as the 76th session of the UN General Assembly, or UNGA, kicks off this week. So, after a year of an all-virtual General Assembly, is New York City ready for gridlock or diplomatic action? Well, VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir joins me from the UN headquarters. I asked her what the mood is like in the city and what kind of COVID-19 restrictions are in place to avoid the assembly being a super spreader event.
I think there's actually excitement about having a big gathering again after so many months of COVID restrictions, COVID lockdowns. And for the city, it's really an economic boost to have leaders in town. The restaurants have been closed, a lot of them for a long time, and Broadway just reopened earlier this month, the theaters. So, and the hotels, some of them have actually been shuttered throughout this because no tourists have been coming to the city. So even though it's a scaled back leaders meeting this year, we still do have more than 100 world leaders attending with small delegations, but that adds up to thousands of people in the city who can contribute to the economy. So I think there's a positive vibe going on about it this year.
And is the city ready? Does the city, New York City, look prepared to handle that much traffic?
Oh, yeah. And when I was coming to work today, the police were already out. The roadblocks were up around the UN. The fire trucks were on standby. The ambulances were on standby. And the city has provided a COVID-19 testing and vaccination site in front of the UN this year in like a mobile truck unit. So leaders can get tested if they want to before they enter the building. In theory, I think most presidents and prime ministers have access to vaccines. Their constituents may not, but they do. And there is an honor system to enter the General Assembly on to give speeches that one should be vaccinated. So we're hoping all leaders follow that. But there is a vaccination ban outside for those who might need one.
And is security asking people to show proof of vaccination?
No, they're not going that far. Some member states objected to that. So there's what they're calling an honor system. But some people are wondering what's going to happen on Tuesday when the first country gives its speech, and that country is traditionally Brazil. And President Bolsonaro has been quite public about the fact that he did not get vaccinated against COVID. And he's supposed to give the speech here on Tuesday. So it will be interesting to see if he violates that honor code by giving his speech, because we all know he's not vaccinated.
Absolutely. That would be very interesting to watch. And before I let you go, Margaret, reports say that this will be obviously an action-packed week at the General Assembly. What are some of the major discussions on the agenda?
Well, I think there's really three. COVID, stopping COVID, and, you know, equitable distribution of vaccines. And then climate change, climate action, because there's a big conference coming up in November in Glasgow, Scotland, and that really needs to be a success. So there's some preliminary work going on here. There was a meeting today between that the UN Secretary General and the Prime Minister of the UK, Boris Johnson, co-hosted with a small group of critical countries on that effort. So there's a lot going on to foster climate action. And then the third big thing, I think that's sort of a big shadow over this whole event is the situation in Afghanistan. And we're going to see discussions and talk, you know, talks on the sidelines and the margins between foreign ministers who are here, between some leaders who are here. On Tuesday, we have speeches from countries like Turkey and Qatar and Iran, who are all very central players to the Afghanistan story. So I think we're going to hear a lot on Afghanistan this week.
That was VOA correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with me from the UN headquarters in New York. And at a news conference, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says that the White House is not changing plans despite President Biden's scheduled appearance in a room with some unvaccinated world leaders.
We obviously take a range of precautions, including ensuring the president is tested. Obviously, he's vaccinated, but there's no intention to change our plans to have him deliver a speech there.
Secretary Psaki was asked if President Biden heads to the UN General Assembly feeling as if ties are strained with some key allies.
The president's view, having been on the world scene for 50 years, is that you always have to work on your relationships, and that includes with global leaders.
That was White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. And President Biden will start easing restrictions on foreign travel into the U.S. starting in November. AP correspondent Saga Megani has more.
The administration will require all foreign nationals flying into the country to be fully vaccinated against COVID-19. They'll have to show proof before boarding, along with a negative result from a test taken within 3 days of a flight. The new policy replaces a patchwork of restrictions that restricted travel by non-citizens who'd been in several countries in the past 2 weeks, including the UK, European Union members, China, and India. The president's also tightening rules for unvaccinated American citizens who will have to be tested before and after returning to the U.S. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. In the Philippines, boxing legend Manny Pacquiao says that he will run for president of the Philippines in next year's elections. Pacquiao, one of the most decorated boxers of his generation, currently serves as a lawmaker in the Senate. He currently leads a faction of the ruling PDP Laban Party. Announcing his candidacy, Pacquiao said that he was ready to tackle corruption, accusing the administration of President Rodrigo Duterte of making corruption worse in the Philippines. Sanre Gajete is a reporter in Manila. I reached him today by phone. He tells me that even though Pacquiao and Duterte are former allies, they have always disagreed on the foreign policy front, especially on the role of China and the South China Sea.
So Jackson, Philippine boxing icon and Senator Manny Pacman Pacquiao announced he will run for president in the 2022 national elections. This was after he accepted the nomination of his Laban Party at its national convention on Sunday. He said that the Philippine people have been waiting for a change of government under the Duterte administration. Pacquiao said that he is a fighter and will always be a fighter inside and outside the boxing ring. The 42-year-old lawmaker also emphasized that the Filipinos need a decent government to serve the people with integrity, compassion, and transparency. We all know that Pacquiao is a world boxing champion and the first boxer to win major world titles in 4 of the 8 glamour divisions, Jackson.
So Manny Pacquiao has been a senator. He has had some history in politics. How has he done so far? And what is it that he has done in his political career so far? Can give us a glimpse on how he would be able to govern as president if he were to be elected.
And actually, when Manny Pacquiao was still a lawmaker way back in 2010, when he started as being a congressman in his province, in Sarangani province, he's advocating for poverty, to fight poverty reduction and for people's rights, including the rights of the athletes. That's what he's campaigning for during that time. But
So he's campaigning on of poverty alleviation.
Yes, poverty alleviation.
What has been the reaction of people in the Philippines to at this announcement?
Well, of course, Jackson, it's a mixed reaction between supporters and those who critic Pacquiao. Of course, for those who support Pacquiao, they believe that Pacquiao can do more when he becomes the president sooner or later, because he is advocating for poverty reduction and alleviation. So they believe that as a president, as a national leader, he will always understand the needs of the people. But of course, for those who critique Pacquiao, they believe that you just need to focus in boxing, not in, you know, aiming for a higher position.
His supporters believe that he will bring the kind of energy that he had in the ring to politics, because sometimes politics can also be akin to boxing. What kind of relationship does he have with the current President Duterte?
Well, right now, Pacquiao and Senator Manny Pacquiao and Duterte has a clash. Pacquiao recently accused the administration of Duterte, his former ally, of making corruption worse in the Philippines, actually. And he warned politicians whom he holds responsible for corruption will soon end in jail together. So right now, there are, you know, rival parties. There's a faction between Duterte and Pacquiao. And Pacquiao believes that the International Criminal Court will lay down all of its cards so that Duterte, who is an advocate of war on drugs, if you know that, will go sooner or later to jail.
The other important question that I wanted to ask you is, in terms of foreign policy, how would he be expected to differ with the current administration?
You know, Jackson, that's the question, because we all know that Pacquiao, even during his Senate, during many Senate sessions, he's not that a strong lawmaker when it comes to making decisions and even in foreign policies. But, you know, he has not yet shared his insights and perspectives, especially when it comes to foreign affairs and even to tackle issues when it comes to the South China Sea territorial dispute. He doesn't have any plans for now. But I believe that when the campaign starts next year, he will lay down. I believe Pacquiao is a great critic of China. That's why he has a clash between Duterte. With Duterte, because Duterte is a strong supporter of China.
Okay, so he differs with Duterte mainly on the issue of China.
Yes, he is always a critic of Duterte because he doesn't want China as an ally of the Philippines. He is always a supporter, actually, of the U.S. Pacquiao is providing and making strong pronouncement against Duterte about the Build program of China.
That was reporter Stanley Gajete speaking to me from Manila. And Lebanon's critical fuel shortages are showing no signs of ending, despite the arrival of Iranian oil smuggled into the country through neighboring Syria. Hezbollah has been arranging the informal oil imports, and prominent political and religious leaders are arguing the new government to crack down on the smuggling. But Prime Minister Najib Mikati denies the government is involved. For VOA, Del Gavlak reports from Amman.
Even Lebanon's parliament has been hit by the rampant power outages. Monday's session to discuss the new government's policies was delayed by an hour because of a power cut. But many Lebanese suffer round-the-clock blackouts, while others wait for hours in long lines outside of gasoline stations, some of them lucky to get a quarter of a tank of gas. Iran-backed Hezbollah has made much fanfare of its initial delivery of Iranian oil into Lebanon last week, portraying itself as the country's savior, stepping in to resolve the acute energy crisis. This latest event gives yet another confirmation that Hezbollah has considerably increased its sway over the Lebanese state. Political scientist Karim Emil Bitar told AFP, "It is no longer even trying to hide behind the veneer of legality offered by official institutions," he said. The shipping monitor TankerTrackers.com has reported that a third Iranian tanker is on its way. Meanwhile, Iraqi fuel is being unloaded in southern Lebanon, according to the National News Agency. Prime Minister Najib Mikati denies the government officially approved the oil delivery, but it certainly has not stopped it. The tankers entered Lebanon from an illegal crossing point from Syria for a transaction that threatens violation of U.S. and other sanctions. Professor Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University tells VOA that Mikati, Hezbollah, and Syria have close connections.
This this is another government born out of Hezbollah's agenda. And Mikati, who has very strong ties with the Syrian regime, is essentially a businessman from the city of Tripoli, where he has behaved like a classic feudal lord. This is exactly what's being done for the entire Lebanese population, keeping everybody on a shoestring with the absolute daily basics, very scarce or absent, and then essentially throwing people a bone here or a bone there. Lebanon is still very far from being out of the woods.
Influential Maronite Catholic Patriarch Bashira Boutros al-Rahi denounced the smuggling of Iranian fuel from Syria in his Sunday sermon, saying the state cannot be built on practices or positions that contradict its entity and institutions. Al-Rahi said the new government should work as a united national team to stop the collapse and confront the continuous attack attempts against the state and its democratic system. Observers point out that neither the arrival of Iraqi fuel to Lebanon's state electricity company nor that of Iranian diesel have so far yielded positive results as the country continues to struggle to keep the lights on. Dale Gavlek for VOA News, Amman.
Voice of America!
And the crisis in Lebanon has left thousands of residents of Beirut suffering from daily power outages. George Eid reports from Beirut on the conditions of residents whose lives have been impacted by the regular power cuts.
In a country that is struggling with hyperinflation and the devaluation of its currency, many Lebanese who can still afford to stock their fridge with products are leaving them almost empty, with daily electric blackouts that span between 2 to 6 hours. Keeping dairy products or meat in the fridge is impossible. Josephine Haddad, who lives in the suburbs of the Lebanese capital, Beirut, says that the situation is becoming more difficult each day.
Where I live, we're having power cuts every other day. There is no fixed schedule to when the electricity would come, when the generator would be on, etc. So the thing is, we're trying to adapt in the sense that we're having some coping mechanisms. We're removing the chicken, the meat from the fridge into the freezer, and whatever product that needs cold temperature. It is becoming a source of major concern because there's children around the house, and we have to make sure whatever they eat is basically good and not poisonous.
The Lebanese government says that due to the current economic crisis, it is unable to ensure the necessary funds to import fuel for its power plants. Because of this, Lebanese are forced to go through hours without any electricity. Local media also reports that many residents are complaining that the blackouts are shortening the lifespan of their electric appliances. Elias Libbo says that even planning for regular grocery shopping has become a hustle, as it is almost impossible to find out when and for how long the electricity would be available on any given weekday.
You can't really store food the way that we used to store it because the fridge is not available 24/7. You have intermittent cuts that are hours long, sometimes 5 to 6 hours, sometimes 3 hours, depends on your area, depends on where you live. For some people, it was a complete blackout. So for a lot of people like me who have a full-time job and who have the privilege to have enough to be able to order from the ever-so-increasing prices of restaurant and food delivery, this was my main solution. I had to start eating everything from restaurants.
Daily power outages have been the norm in Lebanon since the civil war because the state has been unable to produce enough electricity for the entire country. However, recently, due to the declining economic situation, blackouts have increased to more than 12 hours outside the capital. With no plans announced to tackle the issue, the situation does not seem to be getting any better. This is George Aid, reporting for VOA from Beirut.
And in other news, a Iranian court on Monday sentenced Paul Rusesabagina, a one-time hotel manager portrayed as a hero in a Hollywood film about the 1994 Tutsi genocide, to 25 years in prison for terrorism. And in East Asia, fruits are the center of the latest spat between China and Taiwan. Taiwan is threatening to take China to the World Trade Organization after Beijing said that it will suspend sugar apple and wax apple imports from the island over pest concerns. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Within 40 years, more than 800,000 Australians, twice as many as now, will be living with dementia unless a cure is found. That's according to a new government-sponsored report. From Sydney, Phil Masser has more.
Dementia is the second leading cause of death in Australia. A new study by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, a government agency, has forecast that 1.1 million Australians will live with dementia by 2058 unless major new treatments are discovered. Dementia is a broad term for a number of conditions that impair the functions of the brain. In 2019, $2.1 billion was spent in Australia on residential and community-based services and hospital care for dementia patients, two-thirds of whom are women. The release of the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare study has coincided with a new awareness campaign by Dementia Australia, a non-profit organisation. Its chief executive, Marie McCabe, says exercise and a sensible diet can offer protection against several types of dementia.
The main type is Alzheimer's disease, but there are about 100 different types, and about 60% of people with dementia have Alzheimer's disease. But there's types such as frontotemporal dementia, dementia with Lewy bodies, vascular dementia, just to name a few. We can definitely reduce our risk of developing dementia by ensuring that we eat well, that we exercise our body and our brain.
The World Health Organization has said there are currently more than 55 million people living with dementia globally. Almost 10 million new cases are diagnosed every year. About a quarter of those are detected in China, the world's most populous country. It's estimated that 10 million people currently suffer from the degenerative brain disorder in China. As its population ages, that number is forecast to rise to 40 million by 2050, according to a study by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. The study warns that the annual economic costs to China from dementia could reach $1 trillion in medical expenses and lost productivity as caregivers leave the workforce. Dementia support groups warn that worldwide, both patients and caregivers face discrimination because of a lack of understanding about the disease that currently has no cure. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The World Health Organization is warning that COVID-19 vaccine export bans and hoarding by wealthy countries will prolong the pandemic in Africa, preventing recovery from the disease in the rest of the world. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
While more than 60% of the U.S., European Union, and British populations have been vaccinated, only 2% of COVID vaccine shots have been given in Africa. The COVAX facility has slashed its planned COVID-19 vaccine deliveries to Africa by 25% this year. World Health Organization Africa Regional Director Machidiso Moeti says the 470 million doses now expected to arrive by the end of September are enough to vaccinate just 17% of Africans on the continent.
Export bans and vaccine hoarding still have a chokehold on the lifeline of vaccine supplies to Africa. Even if all planned shipments via COVAX and the African Union arrive, Africa still needs almost 500 million more doses to reach the year-end goal. At this rate, the continent may only reach the 40% target by the end of March next year.
WHO reports more than 8 million cases of COVID-19 in Africa, including more than 200,000 deaths. 44 African countries have reported the Alpha variant, and 32 countries have reported the more virulent and contagious Delta variant. Moeti warns of further waves of infection and loss of life in this pandemic. Given the short supply of vaccines, she urges strict adherence to preventive measures such as mask wearing and social distancing. She reiterates WHO's call for a halt to booster shots in wealthy nations, except for those with compromised immune systems and at risk of severe illness and death.
I've said many times that it's in everyone's interest to make sure the most at-risk groups in every country are protected. As it stands, the huge gaps in vaccine equity is not closing anywhere near fast enough. The quickest way to end this pandemic is for countries with reserves to release their doses so that other countries can buy them.
Moeti says African countries with low vaccination rates are breeding grounds for vaccine-resistant variants. She warns this could end up sending the world back to square one. She says the pandemic will continue to ravage communities worldwide if vaccine inequity continues. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
More than 850 former Boko Haram fighters and their family members who escaped from the jihadist group to Cameroon have left northern Cameroon for Nigeria. Nigerian authorities say they are taking the former militants to Nigerian disarmament centers. This after complaints that such centers in Cameroon were overwhelmed by the number of former jihadists defecting since the terrorist group's leader was declared killed in May. Moki Edwin Ginzeka reports from Mora on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria.
Hundreds of people Saturday gathered along streets, watching and waving as 20 buses transporting former Boko Haram militants and their families left Mora, a town on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria, for Banki, a town in Nigeria's Borno State. The governor of Cameroon's far north region, Mijiyawa Bakari, says the former militants agreed to voluntarily return to Nigeria.
Ici, il s'agit de repentir, c'est-à-dire ceux-là même qui ont été prisonniers de Boko Haram.
Bakari says the ex-Boko Haram militants who have agreed to return to Nigeria's Borno State are Nigerian citizens, 854 of them, which also include their families. He says they told Cameroonian government officials that they were either fighters or slaves on plantations controlled by the jihadist group. Bakari says the Nigerian ex-fighters promised to be good citizens of Borno State. Bakari said about 150 more former militants who are of Nigerian nationality will return to their country in the weeks ahead, but he did not explain why they are not returning now. A majority of the ex-militants are women and children. Cameroon said more about 320 males, including young boys among them, are former fighters of the jihadist group. 80 are females the terrorist group used as spies in localities they attacked, authorities said. 454 others are their family members. 34-year-old Kadir Hassan says he is spokesperson of the former Boko Haram militants who agreed to return to Nigeria. He escaped from the Sambisa forest, a Boko Haram stronghold, on the Cameroon-Nigerian border in August. The former fighter says he is looking forward to meeting his relatives in Kukawa, a town in Nigeria's Borno State. Hassan says he left Kukawa to join the jihadist group in March 2020.
Kai, I'm done in Surala Isana, come Nigeria, the world took us a sinner, I don't go back.
Hassan says many Cameroonians and Nigerians he saw in the Sambisa forest want to leave Boko Haram, but are afraid that fighters will kill them. He says he is pleading with the multinational joint task force of the Lake Chad Basin that is fighting the jihadist group to help people who are still under Boko Haram captivity and want to leave. He says the ex-combatants pledge to contribute to the development of their communities when they return to Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Mora, Northern Cameroon.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day ahead.